I'm Frances Callier.
And I'm Angela V. Shelton.
And we're Frangela.
You know what you need in your life? The Final Word Podcast.
Yes, you do.
That's right. It is the final word on all things political and pop cultural.
Where we make real news real funny.
Where we inspire you so you can hashtag resist.
Subscribe and get a new episode of the Final Word Podcast each week. It's the news we think you need to hear.
That's right. We think you need to hear it. Okay.
Yeah, it's what we say so.
That's right. And because all we do is give, every Thursday you can listen to our hysterical podcast, Idiot of the Week.
We round up the stupid because you know what? Somebody has to.
Okay. All we do is give.
MSW Media.
Spy Talk, a podcast at the intersection of intelligence, foreign policy, national security, and military operations.
Hi there, I'm Jeff Stein.
I'm Michael Iskoff.
I'm Karen Greenberg.
And this is Spy Talk. Well, we got a lot to talk about this week. We have a news-making interview with Tom Brzozowski, who until very recent days was counsel for domestic terrorism at the Department of Justice. And boy, has he got a lot to tell us. But first of all, I want to introduce our new panelist. Karen Joy Greenberg knows everybody, but not everybody listening today may know her. But let me just give you a brief resume, and that's going to take some time. A brief resume of Karen's accomplishments. I could go on and on and on singing her praises, but in the last 25 years or so, here are just a few of her highlights. In 2003, she founded and served as executive director of the Center on Law and Security at New York University School of Law. In 2011, she founded the Center on National Security at Fordham University School of Law. She's a widely respected and published expert on national security, particularly in the terrorism realm. And she is the author or editor of 6 books, including Rogue Justice, The Making of the Security State. As I said, I could go on, but I'll just leave it with welcome, Karen. And I'm sorry for the bad pun, but it's a joy to have you here. So what's on your mind this week in the national security sphere?
Well, first of all, thank you so much for that exceptionally kind introduction.
Not at all.
And it's very nice to be here. So what's on my mind this week is what's happening in D.C. with the Metropolitan Police being taken over by the federal government, decreed to be so by the president, Donald Trump. And the reason this concerns me is a variety of reasons. One is I think that Trump for a very long time has had it in his mind of how to federalize troops around the country, be it the National Guard, the Army, whether it's the deployment of the troops and the National Guard earlier this summer in LA or what's happening right now in DC, or take us back to his first term to George Floyd, the Black Lives Matter protests. And so I'm very concerned about this and what it means going forward.
Naturally. And, you know, it provoked me to think this morning about way back in the day, in the last century, in the 1960s, Army intelligence agents were deployed across the country to spy on protesters and dissidents and so on, and civil rights activists and so on. We know that because an Army intelligence whistleblower came forward and told the Washington Monthly about what was going on. And that was no surprise to me in a way, because I was in Army intelligence. So, but I was on the overseas branch, so not working the domestic beat. But anyway, that's something to keep an eye on, and we will down the road. In the meantime, Mike, something that's got your hair on fire, and rightfully so, this week. Tell us about it.
Look, we have been talking nonstop on this podcast about the weaponization of law enforcement and the national security and intelligence agencies. And we had more examples of that. It doesn't stop the purge at the FBI. 5 senior FBI executives
gone,
were purged, fired just in the past week, including Brian Driscoll, who was briefly the acting director of the Bureau, and Steve Jensen, who was the director of the Washington Field Office. These are huge positions. And what was the reason? They are perceived as not sufficiently politically loyal. My understanding is Driscoll was told, orders came from Kash Patel to fire this other agent, Chris Meyer, who actually was the pilot for the FBI. He flies Patel around, apparently worked on January 6 cases or something crazy. But look, we are becoming inured, I suppose, to this because it happens so frequently. But there was a moment this week that really, galvanized this whole experience. And that is Patel declassifies some FBI 302s from 2017 about claims that Adam Schiff, then the ranking Democrat on the House Intelligence Committee, and one of his colleagues, Eric Swalwell, were routinely leaking information from the committee. Now, I've read those 302s. First of all, they date back to activities in 2017, so they're well outside the statute of limitations. There's no corroboration for the claims by a couple of people who are being interviewed. So we don't know whether anybody was able to support. We don't know what Schiff or his counsel might have said about this. But Patel puts it out there anyway. This is an example. This is a perfect example. Remember when Ed Martin, the guy they tried to put in as U.S. attorney, and he couldn't make it, so he goes and heads the weaponization task force. He says, if we can find crimes, we'll charge them. If we're not, we'll shame them. Hmm. Well, this is in the shame category. Patel is just trying to, dust up Adam Schiff, longtime adversary. But the moment that really grabbed me was this comes up at the White House, at a White House briefing. And there is the White House press secretary. We've got a clip of her talking about this, Carolyn Leavitt. And it starts with a question from one of the right-wing influencers who now has seats in the White House press room, asking if the president, quote, plans to investigate Adam Schiff, and what does he believe accountability would look like? Let's listen to the clip.
The president has already said he wants to see Adam Schiff held accountable for the countless lies he told the American people in relation to the Russiagate scandal. I brought Tulsi Gabbard out to this podium to talk to you about all of that. And this administration is taking accountability very seriously. As for this new FBI whistleblower report, I understand Kash Patel last night declassified a 302 FBI document showing that a whistleblower who is a Democrat, a career intelligence officer who worked for Democrats on the House Intel Committee for more than a decade, repeatedly warned the FBI in 2017 that then Rep. Adam Schiff had approved leaking classified information to smear then President Donald Trump over the Russiagate scandal. This is obviously a bombshell whistleblower report. Hopefully more people in this room will cover it as such. And I have a quote from the FBI director for all of you. He has said this: for years, certain officials used their positions to selectively leak classified information to shape political narratives. It was all done with one purpose, to weaponize intelligence and law enforcement for political gain. Those abuses eroded public trust in our institutions. The FBI will now lead the charge with our partners at DOJ, and Congress will have the chance to uncover how political power may have been weaponized and to restore accountability. That's what the administration is focused on, and hopefully we'll see some more media reports on this whistleblower allegation. If this were reversed, if this were allegations against the president or any of these cabinet officials, I'm sure everyone in this room would cover it as such.
I'm sorry. I find this appalling. I mean, is the White House acting as a PR ancillary for the FBI, or is the FBI acting as the PR arm for the White House? It used to be, I'm sure both Karen and Jeff remember this, that there used to be a tradition of independence.
Not only
by
that,
the FBI.
I mean, if you go way back to J. Edgar Hoover, I mean, he was a nasty piece of work himself, but he never let the White House take over what he was doing. And he let Nixon, for sure, know that he'd better stay in his own lane.
Yeah. I mean, listen, the first FBI director I covered was Louis Free, who made it a point of saying he wasn't going to accept a White House pass. He turned it in because he did not want to be perceived as a part of the White House.
Karen?
Not only that, there's been a pretty longstanding tradition of White House communications policies being announced at the beginning of every term or every presidency to say, this is the separation. This is who's going to be allowed to talk. And it's limited often to very few people. This is what they're going to be allowed to talk about, not cases that are in process, et cetera, et cetera. And that's something that Trump in his first term stood away from in terms of the AG drafting that memo or releasing that memo and instead put it in the White House counsel's hand. And it's something that, to my knowledge, we haven't seen in this presidency. Merrick Garland, of course, did it practically on the first day of his time in office. So I'm just saying this is thought of ahead of time. And the norms are being erased. And here's an example.
Yeah, this is Trump 2.0. The first administration, he was cautious about the establishment in Washington this time around, and we're not the first to say this. He is big, bad, and bold, and breaking all the norms.
Well, on that note, we've got a guest, I understand, who can talk to us about norms being broken at the Justice Department.
For sure. Tom Brzozowski was, until very recently, as I said at the top of the show, counsel for domestic terrorism at the Department of Justice. And I had a chat with him last week in which he told me some, well, I suppose in a prior context, I would have called it astounding and mind-blowing things about what's going on inside the Justice Department. But these days, it's like, oh, yeah, it's just another, rule-breaking by the Trump administration. But what he's going to tell you in practical terms about what the administration is doing in regard to domestic terrorism or not doing in this case. And Tom is very worried about the level of violence in the country right now, as he'll tell you, I'm sure, on the show when we talk to him. But without further ado, let's bring him on. Tom Brzozowski, welcome to Spy Talk. It's just an honor to have you here. Well, we had a brief chat last week about what's going on inside the Department of Justice and domestic terrorism, and you alarmed me with a couple of things you said. One is that basically domestic terrorism tracking, enforcement, all the functions of domestic terrorism in the Justice Department have been wiped out, essentially. Same at FBI, same at DHS, that we're essentially disarming ourselves. And maybe we're thankful about that with the Trump administration excesses. But anyway, at the same time, you said you were alarmed at the general level of violence, domestic violence going on. So let's go over that, Tom. What's going on inside the Justice Department and domestic terrorism?
Sure. Well, first of all, thanks for the opportunity to join the panel. I really appreciate it.
Our pleasure.
I've been calling you guys for some time. So thanks again for the opportunity. Just a couple caveats are probably in order to make sure that that folks get a fair appreciation for my perspective.
Sure.
I have not been actively engaged on issues directly related to domestic terrorism for a couple weeks now, so probably close to 7 or 8 weeks, maybe. So that being said, I've been following the developments very closely. It's really probably not terribly different from what you've been able to read in any number of publications that have addressed this issue over the last couple of months. So I can give you the kind of parade of horribles, if you like. There's been a clear retreat by the federal government in the fight against violent extremism. I think that's hardly a controversial thing to say. That includes a redirecting of counterterrorism personnel and funds towards other priority issues like deportation. And now, of course, apparently local law enforcement and D.C.
Is there anyone working on domestic terrorism in the Justice Department today?
Yes, yes. And that was going to be my
second. What are they doing?
So, you know, I'm not, I certainly wouldn't mean to suggest or imply that there's been a wholesale abandonment of issues related to domestic terrorism within both the FBI and the Department of Justice. That simply wouldn't be the truth. It's not the case that if there were some sort of terrorism-related incident that occurs in the United States, that the Bureau and the Department of Justice would not investigate it and prosecute it. Of course they would. What I'm saying is that although, and you've heard public statements to this effect issued by the department's public affairs office indicating that they continue to investigate and prosecute domestic terrorism as they always have, and international terrorism, of course. The broader point that I was making in our previous conversation was that whereas that might be there, they may say that their ability to execute that is rapidly diminishing.
Their ability to execute what?
Investigate, properly investigate and prosecute issues related to violent extremism. And that is a byproduct of, again, the parade of horribles that you typically probably have already read about, namely the redirecting of counterterrorism personnel and funds, the massive budget cuts that have largely gutted terrorism-related law enforcement training and shut down whole swaths of research dedicated to domestic terrorism and violent extremism research. The ODNI's recent release of the strategic intelligence plan associated with the last national strategy for countering domestic terrorism, characterizing it as a chilling plot to weaponize the intelligence apparatus against the American people, which of course is, that's simply not true. Mm-hmm. And I know that obviously from having worked hand in glove with a number of my colleagues on that very issue. There is presently an opaque understanding of the current national security policy discussions ongoing within the department and in the Bureau. And what do I mean by that? We simply don't know what the priorities are. We simply don't know how or to what extent the administration intends to address violent extremism, because we've received no indication of that this is where this stacks against competing priorities.
I want to let Karen and Mike jump in here, but before I get to that, I want to ask you one question. Before, in the first administration, the Trump people went after domestic terrorism monitoring and so on because they said it was all set up to clamp down on right-wing or conservative activity and so on. Has that been the state of play now? Do you think that's what's behind shutting down domestic terrorism concerns now?
Yeah. So again, I understand the necessity of addressing what is in truth the wholesale dismantling of the national security architecture related to violent extremism. That clearly is underway. That is happening. And I'm not disputing that. But what I'm reluctant to do is to kind of bathe in a cesspool of cynicism and just sort of marinate in it.
Oh, go ahead.
I'm really more.
That's what we do on this podcast.
I'm really interested in trying to eliminate some forward thinking policy proposals for a way forward. To remind ourselves that this doesn't have to be kind of the end state.
Well, Mike, with all due apologies, you're out now. So your policy proposals don't have a lot of traction right now. We want to know, before we move on to what the future might look like and your proposals, we want to know what's going on now inside the Bureau and the FBI. I mean, the DOJ and the FBI.
Yeah, and you can see, I think the what was particularly alarming to me, of course, was the most recent slate of firings over at FBI headquarters and around the country of top level senior FBI officials for blatantly political purposes. I haven't seen any indication that they were terminated for anything other than naked partisan issues. And that's unfortunate because I've worked with these people before on issues related to violent extremism. I know them personally.
Tom, just a couple of threshold questions here. You were the counselor to the domestic terrorism, was it unit, division, section in the criminal division? Is that?
Yeah. A word probably might be helpful to this kind of situate in the constellation of folks that work on this issue. So I was initially hired by the Assistant Attorney General, John Carlin, when he had that post back in 2015, to be the counsel for domestic terrorism for the National Security Division within the Department of Justice. Okay, so over time, I've never not held that position, but where I've been situated in the org chart has fluctuated. So I'm presently, my last assignment was within the counterterrorism section. So I fell under the section chief of the counterterrorism section. And then you may recall that several years ago, within the National Security Division, a domestic terrorism unit was created. And so I was working hand in glove with other prosecutors that were part of that effort. So it was all, but it was all within the National Security Division.
Did you resign or were you forced out?
Neither. I sort of resigned. I retired, technically. I took an opportunity that was offered to me for early retirement.
And why did you do so?
Because I had no longer had a functioning job. There was nothing for me to do anymore. Because again, my role was essentially to cast a wide net across government on all things related to violent extremism. And then use that information to inform policymakers both within the Department of Justice and, again, across government. I work very closely with the National Security Council and many other departments and agencies and international partners on these issues. And when I did that survey of what was transpiring across government there, I could see it being rapidly, the architecture that had been created over the last several years was being rapidly deconstructed. And so I couldn't, in good conscience, continue to hold myself out as counsel for domestic terrorism when it became evident to me that that was simply not going to be something that I would be permitted to work on. And so as a consequence, I took the early retirement with the hope, and this is to your point, sir, I know that I have very little impact these days, but with the hope that perhaps outside of government, I could perform some sort of service in potentially reordering what we can do, or proposing, again, forward-thinking policy proposals to move us in the right direction, get us out of where we the
good luck with heading. Good luck with that.
I'm an optimist.
I'm curious about the domestic terrorism unit that you were working at, under Biden, right? What were you looking at? What kinds of issues? What kinds of groups? What were the biggest threats that you saw at the time?
Well, really, again, if you can kind of get a sense of precisely what the domestic terrorism unit was all about, if you look at some of the legacy justice manual provisions that were promulgated at the same time that the unit itself was erected. And those really were designed to effectively streamline information that we derive from U.S. attorneys' offices around the country related to domestic terrorism. So that was pillar number
where
one.
Where were the threats? Where did you see? What groups did you see? What were you looking at? Like what did you see were the, highest threat levels that you were really concerned about at the time?
Yeah. So I can tell you that the one that started to take hold right when the domestic terrorism unit was stood up, concerned in many respects, very loosely networked transnational organizations that operated primarily online and disparate channels and chat platforms like Discord and Telegram and what have you. So that quickly became something of a priority for us.
So such as
Telegram Collective.
Telegram, of course, which
764.
Yeah. Right.
The Com. And there's a slew of that being said, there was also a steady drumbeat of other activity associated with what used to be called racially and ethnically motivated violent extremism, or REMV. So you had, Brandon Russell plotting to bomb critical infrastructure in Maryland. You had other individuals who were associated with anarchist extremism up in North Dakota and South Dakota, targeting critical infrastructure up there. And there was a slew of activity by individuals whose ideological motivation spanned the entire divide from, again, environmental extremists on one end, all the way to, accelerationist neo-Nazis on the other.
And yet the government, various government agencies from FBI, the Justice Department, Capitol Police, and so on, have been knocked for not getting a grip on the growing threat of violence at the Capitol on the famous January 6th.
Yeah, that's a bit of a separate issue in my respect, because what that does is it sweeps in an absolutely necessary discussion of the intersection of privacy, civil liberties, and intelligence, domestic intelligence collection. That's, we could do a whole separate like hour thing on that if you like. But
let's do 5 minutes.
You're on.
Fundamentally, like at its core, what you had is a tension between the provisions with that the FBI that guide what the FBI is allowed to do or not do, and that's contained in their domestic intelligence operations guides, DIOG, if you will, and especially those provisions are fairly restrictive in a domestic context.
Were they more restricted in terms of these right-wing groups under the Trump administration? Were you told to lay off those groups?
No. Again,
Proud Boys.
I don't want to disappoint you. Yeah, I don't want to disappoint you, but there was nothing along those lines at all. In fact, okay. I will give due credit to the initial Trump administration, because it's important to calibrate criticism here and ensure that it's informed and it's not just sort of spasmodic because people kind of have it. I've seen this tendency of that to happen over the last couple of months, and rightly so. I get it. I get where it comes from, but I don't think it's helpful. So under the first Trump administration, they were the first to actually incorporate reference to domestic terrorism in their national security strategy.
That's right.
No other previous administration had done that.
But can we talk about why they hadn't put it in?
I think it was because, you know, and again, I don't want to speak out of turn here. I'm not a historian of the National Security Agency or anything like that, but I think if I were pressed, I would say, look, you had a window between the Church Committee investigation, you know, and it's you know,
1970s investigation of intelligence agency.
Yeah. And then there was a slew of regulatory and statutory measures that were promulgated in the wake of that investigation, including FISA, including the Attorney General guidelines, for example. And so
wiretapping guidelines. Yeah,
that's exactly right. Exactly right. So I think that there was a reticence to squarely address domestic intelligence issues by the government in that period for reasons probably prophylactic reasons. Namely, they didn't want to be considered to be unnecessarily trampling on the civil liberties of American citizens and re-invite criticism that had been generated in the lead up to the Watergate investigation. And that's because, again, for the lay public, they may not fully appreciate the degree to which those principles that flowed from the Watergate investigation are incorporated into the governing regulatory body that dictates what the FBI can and can't do. It is deeply rooted there, that those civil liberties concerns, deeply rooted in what the FBI can and can't do. And that is drilled into agents. I know, because I was formerly, before I became the National Security Council, I was an attorney for the FBI. It was my job to train them on this stuff. Mm-hmm. So I'm not speaking out of turn. I know this stuff.
So do you think,
I think there was a reticence there. So that's probably what accounted for it.
So do you think there's a confusion, either short-term or long-term perspective-wise, about what exactly those civil liberties concerns are? For example, the line between ideology and, you know, speech that's really, you know, impassioned and what you're allowed to investigate, arrest, et cetera, for. Is that line clear? Is it fuzzy? Is it something that you think's been a problem? Is it something we still need to work on? What's your sense here?
Yeah, so I've spent a lot of time thinking about this, and I know. Because of the nature of my work, I've been forced to be a little bit of a First Amendment scholar.
No, I know.
Quasi-scholar, if you will, just taking a look at this stuff.
Yeah.
Because on the one hand, there is a ton of training that goes into ensuring that both the FBI, principally the FBI, because they're the folks that are going to initiate the investigations that are later going to be handed off to an AUSA for prosecution, for example. Mm-hmm. So it really all starts at the FBI for the most part. There are other agencies that obviously will have a hand in this here and again, but it's drilled into them from day one. In fact, all their slide decks that are typically used in training. And by the way, as another caveat, everything I'm talking about here is unclass, and all my work typically is unclass. There's only a
small. Yeah, and I have to say that I think we're talking about the past FBI, because we have a new FBI that's investigating the president, President Obama, for treason.
We do. We do. And we do. Sir, you are absolutely correct. And so I'm referring to the FBI that I know or I knew. And I am not prepared to editorialize on what they may or may not be doing right now, because I'm not privy to it. But the way it used to be is that most training sessions would have a slide on there that was, you know, big as day, that said the FBI does not investigate First Amendment protected speech. Now, obviously, you know, the FBI is a large organization. It's got a lot of folks on the ground. Most of them are not lawyers. You know, the nuances associated with, you know, the types of prescribed speech and the types of speech that enjoy constitutional protection is complicated. It's super complicated. The Supreme Court sometimes screws it up, you know, like discerning between the fine line between incitement and true threats and things like that. So occasionally, you know, it's tough to draw that line, for sure. But the training is there. It's very robust. I can definitely speak to that.
So, Tom, you mentioned before that a lot of these right-wing groups that you were investigating or were on your radar had transnational dimensions to it. And I know in one case, I think it was the Russian Imperial Movement, it was designated as a foreign terrorist organization that had ties to folks inside the country. But there are others. I'm thinking of the Azov Brigade in Ukraine. A lot of attention has been on that and potential ties they have in the United States. The base, a big case some years ago, whites, a really ugly, nasty white supremacist group. There was a figure. There were some indications they were taking direction from a figure who had fled to Russia and was living in Russia. Yet there's only been that one designation of the right wing group in Russia. Why weren't more designated, and why wasn't more done to explore these transnational links that some of these groups had?
Well, there's a lot to unpack there. First, just to kind of clarify the record. Actually, the State Department, first of all, has point on.
They did the designations on.
Obviously,
Russian
that's going to be, yes, with impact, with input from DOJ for sure.
Right.
We've got a team, or had a team, again, I don't speak in the past tense here, but right, it would review those. So to date, as far as I'm aware, you've got the Russian imperialist movement that has been designated not as a form. And this is important to understand. I don't want to get into the weeds too much, but. Not as a foreign terrorist organization, but rather through the SDGT process, the specially designated global terrorist designation, which is more of a economic sanction, if you will, as opposed to a designation per se. It simply it excludes that entity and people affiliated with that entity from essentially the U.S. financial system, really. It makes it a crime to contribute in monies or material support to those entities. I can answer more questions about that process if you'd like. But the NRM has also been designated, Nordic Resistance Movement.
What is that again, please?
The Nordic Resistance Movement, which is another transnational.
When was that?
That was done a couple months ago.
Okay. Missed it.
And then the Terragram Collective that I just referred to is also recently designated.
Yeah.
So
there was an arrest recently.
Was that under this administration? The Trump 2.0?
It was. Now, right. That being said, you have to understand that there's a long tail to this process. So there's an administrative record that is compiled by lawyers and analysts and agents, you know, over time in order to get to the point where the designation is made. So that was in train well before the Trump administration came on board. And it simply popped a month or two into the Trump administration. If you look back, you have to confirm my dates.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I'm referring to the Terragram Collective.
Yeah.
So there have been, and by the way, and sir, I should say that actually I've spent, strangely enough, you know, as the counselor for domestic terrorism, over the last 3 years since COVID, The bulk of my work has been overseas. I've been working with hand in glove with Europol, Eurojust, Interpol.
On these particular groups, the Nordic group and the Telegram group?
Yeah. The European Union, the Council
AfD
of Europe.
In Germany, the right-wing political party in Germany, now the second most powerful political party in Germany, the AfD.
Right.
Some of whose members tried a coup d'etat a couple of years ago.
Yeah, so wait a minute, Tom. I just want to ask. So this is kind of interesting because legal, in terms of the law, right, the ability to name a terrorist organization, right, the foreign terrorist organization list, the and the one you referred to, the ability to, you know, investigate, the powers are much larger when it comes to an international connection. One of the things your career has really been focused on is the legislative path to getting a Domestic Terrorism Act on the books. And so is the reason that you were working in the international sphere because the legal road to do that was clear and there and usable? You know, that if you have an international connection, it's there are so many more ways that you're allowed to investigate and coordinate these investigations. And is that something that you see in your mind as being separate from the domestic terrorist organizations or extremist groups that were not affiliated in any, you know, legally useful way in the domestic sphere?
Okay, so it certainly is the case that there are more investigative tools available in the context of an international terrorism investigation than would be on offer for a purely domestic terrorism investigation. And you know, the prime one, of course, is the use of FISA, which most people would probably be familiar with. That being said,
easier to wiretap when suspected foreign terrorists are involved.
Well, you're just able to leverage other tools, more sophisticated tools, like FISA is what I'm getting at here. You know, the rules that govern regular wiretaps are certainly applicable to domestic terrorism investigations. And again, I should probably just note here that, you know, again, folks might think that if like a domestic terrorism investigation somehow affords the FBI additional tools that it would otherwise not have if it were just having like investigating a regular criminal offense or regular federal criminal offense. That's not the case.
Right.
It's they're effectively the same tools.
Mm-hmm.
There are additional safeguards and protocols in place that relate to, believe it or not, some of the civil liberties concerns associated with that. If you are undertaking a domestic terrorism investigation, and I can address that later on if you like. But to your question, the reason I've been involved more heavily on the international, I call it transnational piece, because these cases technically aren't, they don't fit the rubric of what we would understand to be quintessential international terrorism cases, because they're not these shadowy networked organizations that are global in nature, that exist primarily online or on the internet. They're not related to a particular named FTO, foreign terrorist organization. They're not really tied to a particular foreign power or foreign government. Now, there is some interesting intelligence, and you know, and it's open source that the leader of the base, to your point, sir, actually is this guy named Nazarov, who presently lives in Russia. But,
right, exactly.
It's setting that aside.
And as I remember it, the base was a pretty nasty group. They had plans to, kill African Americans in Georgia. There was a big plot to do so that was busted.
You're totally you're on point about that. And the interesting thing about the base, and this ties into your question, Lori, is the you know, part of what I would do, for example, one of the things I did was I went over and I briefed the EU body, EU COTER, it's called COTER. It's the entity that essentially addresses external threats to the EU and determines what measures the EU might take to combat these external threats that might have bearing on the EU. And one of those threats that was front and center for the EU was the base, believe it or not. That
so the guy in Russia, Nazarov is his name, I believe.
That's right.
Do I have that right? Has he been indicted? And if not, why not?
I believe, and I don't want to speak out of turn here because I got to check. There's been activity related to him, if I'm not mistaken. But I don't want to comment on that. I can get back to you on that. Because I don't want to
Yeah, no, it was a big case.
But I mean, it's open source information. Clearly, he's the purported leader of the organization. It's clear that he lives in Russia. We know that for a fact. But more to the point of why I was doing a lot of the work on the transnational pieces, briefing the EU, for example, on the cases that you just noted, sir, namely the one in Georgia. There were several other cases that were brought federally in connection with the base. And the idea was, we're supposed to inform the EU about the lethality associated with this organization. They take that information in concert with some of the member countries that had present litigation associated with the base, including the Netherlands. And then, if you didn't already know, as a response to that, the EU exercised for the first time ever its prescription authority to ban the base across the entire EU.
And when did that happen? When was that?
That happened a couple months ago.
Yeah.
Okay. Recently.
Fairly recently. Yeah.
Can we go back to where we started when you said that your office has essentially been dismantled? Put some flesh on that. How many people were in it? How did this dismantling play out? Were people ordered to leave? Were they reassigned? Did they quit? And who are you reporting to? And where was the new directives, to the extent that you had them, coming from? From who?
Well, there was no official dismantling of the unit. Again, I can't speak to what has been communicated within the department for the last couple of weeks. Like I said before, I've been out for a little bit.
Right.
So when I left, I can say that the unit itself is not a creature of statute. So it was simply an internal determination to build this. So it had no statutory scaffolding to it. So it could come and it can go at the whim of whoever is in charge. So that's important to note. And so if there is a policy determination that makes it go away, fine, fair enough. There's nothing.
And how many people had to go away?
And again, it was a death by a thousand cuts, if you will, more of an attrition, a slow kind of.
Since January.
I don't want to say malign indifference, because you know, it wasn't as if we were called into a conference room and fired or whatever, or reassigned. That never happened. It was just never.
One by one, people were disappearing.
They went into other parts of the DOJ, yes. Right? They were just taken out of
that. So how many people were you talking about? How many people were in the unit? How many people were there when you left?
We had, and again, initially, just to give you a frame of reference, for the first several years, the work, I did the work myself. Sort of obviously not terribly well, because I was the only one person, I could only do what I could do.
When are you talking about? When you were
2015 through 2000.
Okay, and then the unit grew to how many people at the time that the attrition started?
Eight or nine attorneys.
And support. So that's the entire office of domestic terror with eight or nine attorneys.
No.
We're trying to quantify these cuts.
Yeah. So again, it's more to note that our role at the National Security Division, like what we do, the folks that were that, and I already explained what I did, and I'm the type of guy that had a foot in, a toehold in operations. I was conversant in what was going on, the investigations that were being undertaken. I went to the meetings with the FBI, all that kind of stuff, just so that I could understand what's going on. But most of my work was policy oriented. I don't want to spend too much more time on what I did, but my colleagues are very different. Most of my colleagues that are in the National Security Division perform very different roles. They're trial attorneys. And so what they do, they're attorneys with a ton of experience. And I should take this second to plug them as well. I'm deeply respectful of all they're doing and continue to do, as well as my colleagues at the FBI. These are the people who are the best in the world at what they do. And what they do is assist line prosecutors in the field. So other federal prosecutors who are actually going into court and trying cases or investigating, and then FBI agents who are distributed across the country who are undertaking these investigations. So you would think of it as more of a and supervisory is the wrong word, really, because it's more collaborative. You work with these federal prosecutors to help them navigate. There's a whole slew of regulatory
I think we wanted to be clear on the numbers. You said that there were 8 or 9 attorneys at the unit at its peak
in the National Security Division Domestic Terrorism Unit. That's correct.
And how many? How many when you left?
The unit didn't exist per se because there was no. For example, like if you were to look at the org chart, there would no longer be a domestic terrorism signifier.
So all 8 or 9 of those lawyers were moved, transferred elsewhere.
And so it doesn't exist on the organizational chart anymore?
It's not my understanding.
But I just want to get back to the National Security Division just to talk about it, because National Security Division still exists, right?
Yeah, of course.
It's, you know, right. And it was set up initially in 2006 for the purpose of international terrorism prosecutions, correct?
In part, yeah.
Yeah. I mean,
but its remit also included domestic terrorism. It's supposed to coordinate all terrorism related.
Right. But that remit got enhanced over time, right? I mean, the domestic terrorism part of it grew over time from its initial years.
I would say that, and I would say this, the short answer is yes, for sure.
Yeah,
But I think the reason for that is that whereas there was an understanding that the National Security Division surely had a responsibility to cover domestic terrorism as well as international terrorism, there was a period of time, principally in the 2015 era, where, to his credit, John Carlin, again, recognized, and this was in the wake of the Kevin Harpham attack, you may recall, up in Spokane, where he was a neo-Nazi who planted a bunch of IEDs along the parade route of a MLK parade.
Mm-hmm.
Very sophisticated devices that really could have wreaked a lot of damage. Luckily, they were found ahead of time. But in any event, and it was also in the wake of or in the teeth of the incipient ISIS crisis. So there was a tension there. The vast majority of the work that the DOJ was undertaking, including the National Security Division, was almost entirely dedicated to ISIS, foreign fighters,
everything else. Yeah.
And there was a realization that, wait a second, we just almost had a catastrophic domestic terrorism attack. Maybe we should right size a little bit and figure out what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
And so they brought me on board just to take a look and see what's what. And then it over time, over the last 10 years, it has become what it has become. So to your point, yes, it has.
So are we back to before that now? Or are we basically working, you know, back to that? Because, you know,
I feel like we are. I feel like we've regressed to the point where that's where we are. When the administration came in, the attorneys that were assigned to the domestic terrorism unit had a caseload, all of which concerned domestic terrorism cases. Within the span of several months, and it accelerated towards my departure, the time when I departed, those attorneys began to receive cases that had nothing to do with domestic terrorism as part of their workload. And they were pulled off domestic terrorism cases and reassigned. Some attorneys were completely reassigned.
Does this mean that some vital domestic terrorism cases were aborted?
No. They are still being prosecuted and investigated. There's not, again, that's why I don't want to be overly alarmist about what's transpiring here.
What about the FBI? Is the FBI still, you know, what's happened within the FBI? Do you know, in terms of these cases, what authorities they have? Who's addressing this, how they relate to the JTTFs?
So when I departed, the big thing that transpired was that, you know, again, at FBI headquarters, there's a thing called the Domestic Terrorism Operations Section.
Yeah.
That is a group of agents and usually supervisory special agents who program manage all of the investigations around the country that relate to domestic terrorism. Okay. The people that are actually putting on the flak jackets and doing the investigations, those are through the JTTFs that are mm-hmm. around the country, spread out around the country. Half of that section was reassigned to other duties. That I can say for sure.
About how many people is that?
Okay. The numbers thing, you're killing me here with the numbers. I mean,
yeah, that's what we do.
I just don't want to get locked into a number.
No, you don't have to have an exact number about how many people were working in that office.
Gosh. I want to say 50 or it had to be 50 to 60 people were part of probably a little bit because I'm
and half of them reassigned.
Reassigned to other duties. Correct.
So, Tom, can you walk us through your own decision to retire or resign. What prompted you to do that? What was your frustrations? And then who did you communicate to when you left, and what was their response?
You know, I looked around and I saw my leadership, you know, career prosecutors, agents that I've worked with for years, people who have vast expertise in counterterrorism. They're, you know, being pushed aside, reassigned. The folks in the building, I should say, like my immediate supervisor, did everything that they could to insulate me from that, because my given my title and the work that I'd undertaken, there was a fear that I could be potentially, for some reason, and it's really difficult to discern these reasons sometimes, on some kind of list to be.
Did you work on the January 6th cases?
I didn't have direct. Again, my role is not a direct. I'm more of a policy person, so I didn't work on them per se. But I was certainly in the room when a lot of these conversations about how to charge these guys was being done.
It's so bad enough.
I was part of the conversation for sure. So I was, you know, but the, you know, my leadership bent over backwards to insulate me and protect me. But again, by reassigning me, give me a different role, having me work on different projects, which is great, and I sincerely appreciate that them for that. But, you know, I had more concerns for the institution itself. Initially, there was this feeling, well, we can hold the line and we'll just stay put and kind of weather the storm. But it became clear that when you, with the, you know, get the leadership being pushed out and dissenting voices being silenced, or dissenting voices being perceived as disloyalty, even worse.
Mm-hmm.
You've got a scenario where compliance is rewarded over like curiosity. And not to overstate it, but it became kind of clear to me that we were running into a system where the justice system seemed to start to weaponize its own mechanisms against the very people it was sworn to protect, which is a dangerous spot to be in. And I don't say that lightly, but I mean, again, the news cycle speaks for itself. And it's hard not to draw a conclusion that, you know, we're on the teeth of a scenario where, again, the apparatus of government, is, you know, on the one hand, I want to say it's not as if this is happening like front and center with sirens blaring and, you know, but it kind of is a little bit. I mean, we're seeing that actually happen. But the deeper concern I have anyway is kind of the insidious force of vacancy, if you will, is one way to put it. You've got, you know, skilled judgment that's not being used. You've got complex decisions made by people who have no lived experience of how to do the work. And that is going to create a culture of, and it already has. I mean, if you've got any contacts within the FBI, the DOJ, you'll hear them tell you this. It creates a culture of fear. You know, and that is going to necessarily seep into how we as a community outside of government relate to these agencies and departments that are supposed to be doing the work of us.
Did you have any dealings with Emile Bove or any other top officials? The Justice Department.
I was in line ahead of him to get coffee one time, but okay. Other than that, I mean,
well, he didn't cut in front of you.
We got to start.
I'll give him.
Hey,
that.
Tom, can I ask you one question that's just on my mind, because you've worked for so long on how to define domestic terrorism? You know, yeah. As part of the Domestic Terrorism Act that you were, you know, rallying forces around. And do you think that, in addition to getting rid of, you know, REMV and other terms that are, you know, the terms used within the government for different forms of terrorism here, do you think that given what's happened now, you see a change in how we understand the definition of domestic terrorism?
Well, again, my approach to that over the last 10 years has been to, and again, the approach of the FBI and the approach of my colleagues in the department has been to as diligently as possible hew to, and we've talked about this, statutory definition of domestic terrorism. So we're not making it up. We're not pulling it out of the ether. It's Congress passed a statute which defined what domestic terrorism is and what it is not. And so our role and responsibility, at least as we viewed it, was to tie as closely as possible our work related to domestic terrorism to that statutory definition. Now, my fear is that that understanding is no longer in place by folks that are working issues related to domestic violent extremism. They can't, because normally when you have an inbound administration or inbound senior officials that relate that are going to do work in the National Security Division, for example, domestic terrorism is not something that, that most of them have any particular familiarity with.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's a period of time where you got to orient them to the legal landscape and kind of train them up a little bit so that they can make principled policy decisions and know what they're talking about when they address the issue, either to whatever audience they might be speaking
and
to.
And it's very complicated in terms of civil liberties and protected speech. And
yes, sir. Absolutely.
Yada,
the whole, there's a constellation of issues that, that are orbit domestic terrorism. And you've named many of them, but there are many, many others. And so it's tentacles spread all there. I'm mixing all kinds of metaphors here. But in any event, my concern is that now any kind of relation or reference to domestic terrorism by senior officials in any context is untethered from any kind of statutory definition. And as a consequence, because the term is so significant and is has the potential to be used as a political cudgel, that it will be. It'll be deployed in a political context, untethered from its actual statutory meaning. And then moreover, like the constellation of issues I told you about, the ability to aggregate any data associated with what we're doing in the context of domestic terrorism, number of domestic terrorism investigations, number of domestic terrorism prosecutions, that's all gone. So now we have no data. We can't allocate resources appropriately with no data.
Wow.
We can't speak to the issue or the threat itself. Like, think about the intelligence implications of this.
I want to talk about that threat. We got to start wrapping this up, Tom. It's been fascinating and frightening. I want to go back up to 30,000 feet. When we talked, I want to ask you again the question we chatted about last week when we first got to know each other, which is, I asked you, if you were to revert to the old chart we had right after 9/11, the color-coded chart of terrorist fears and alerts from green to yellow to red, I said, where would you put that alarm level, that threat level today?
Yeah, and I did say red. I think that might sound alarmist. I get it. And I also have not been privy to the most recent intelligence. So that is going to be, I offer that as a caveat. But the reason I say red is because I read in the newspaper every day. And I'm trying to stay abreast of what's transpiring.
And where are the biggest threats coming from?
Well, we had discussed, and again, this is a kind of a loaded term, and a lot of scholars kind of quibble about whether this is a thing or not, but I introduced the concept of stochastic terrorism. That is certainly a driver here.
What does that mean, stochastic terrorism?
It's where rhetoric is elevated to such a fever pitch that it engenders a reaction in others who are disassociated with the person that's made the statement, but give effect to it through violence.
Would that be like the guy who attacked the CDC down in Atlanta?
Right. That's an example. That's a good example. The guy.
So we can trace that, I suppose, at least with dots, to RFK Jr. and his excoriation of vaccines.
Well, yeah, I mean, there are any number of statements that have been made by any number of officials, both in government and outside of government. That again, I'm not suggesting that there is a causal connection, but necessarily between that. I'm not suggesting that they wanted to bring into effect this violence.
No,
that was something that they intended.
But we can see the locomotive in the caboose here.
Sure. If you think about
violent
the
rhetoric, including, by the way, about the former president of the United States, Barack Obama.
Well, you see,
and others associated with the Russia investigation.
Right. That's right. And then, I mean, the most immediate example.
And federal judges.
Federal judges, the state lawmakers in Minnesota. I mean, it doesn't, it's literally Exhibit A. Like, there's no refuting the fact that we've created a culture where we've, again, elevated the discourse to such a point where there are individuals out there. And I'm not blaming the discourse entirely. I think it's also a function of the ecosystem that we live in. It's you know, distributed, balkanized media environment where people consume all kinds of stuff, just what they want to hear. It gets amplified, gets elevated, and then they give effect to it. So that's really going to be part of it.
I should ask, there's been a lot of attention lately about acts of anti-Semitic violence, the attack on Governor Shapiro's residence, the shooting at the Jewish Museum here in Washington. How concerning was this? Were you seeing a trend alarming that was concerning? And also, was there any connection you saw, because this has been claimed, from Hamas or other Palestinian terrorist groups with some of the developments taking place on college campuses and other protests?
Well, I think that the conflict certainly has generated a fair amount of the violence. I don't think that's controversial to say. The assassination of the two young Jewish folks mm-hmm. that were leaving the museum by an individual, as I understand it, that it was very much affiliated with the issues that were occurring in Gaza. So that clearly was at least a motivating factor in that particular violent episode. Mm-hmm. To what extent Hamas has been specifically involved in some of this activity, even if I were at liberty to discuss that, that would fall into the international terrorism arena. All that stuff is classified. I can't really touch the Hamas thing. But I will say that there have been deliberate and sustained efforts undertaken by the current administration. I think they're all in on the anti-Semitic stuff. There are all kinds of task forces that are looking at this kind of thing. So they are certainly aware of it and looking to combat it. But, you know, again, if you turn right around and look at like stats built stats from ADL and what have mm-hmm. you, they'll show the trend line has been going nothing but up at an alarming rate. Yeah. So not just this year, but in the preceding couple of years as well.
I got one last question for you on a completely different subject.
Okay, fire away.
The Attorney General, Pam Bondi, announced, this is late-breaking news today, on Thursday, that the guy who got arrested for throwing the sandwich at the police officer in D.C. The Subway sandwich was a Justice Department employee. His name was Sean Dunn. He worked as an international affairs specialist in the criminal division of the Justice Department. Did you know him?
I did not know him.
I did. And you're glad.
What's your...
I hate to end on that note, but...
All right. You let us down.
That's good. I was not familiar with the Subway sandwich assault, so I have to check that out.
Yeah. All
be right. Interesting to see if he's prosecuted as a terrorist on terrorist.
Yeah. Sounds like the sandwich as a terror weapon.
There you go.
Pretty soon you won't be able to bring sandwiches onto airplanes.
Right? No way. Absolutely not. Checking dangerous. It's security. Dangerous.
Well, anyway, Tom, thanks for coming on the Spy Talk podcast. It's just been great, very illuminating, alarming, educational, all the above. So thanks again for being here.
Thank you for the opportunity. Really appreciate it. It was great talking with you.
See you around. And that's it for this week's Spy Talk. Be sure to check out our complete podcast archive on Apple or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you haven't done so already, do check out the spytalk.co news site on Substack, where we offer a steady diet of scoops and original analyses on the intersection of intelligence, foreign policy, and military operations. Just Google Spy Talk and you'll quickly find your way there. This edition of the Spy Talk podcast was smoothly produced, as always, by Kanai and edited by Molly Hawkey for MSW Media. And so that's it for now. I'm Jeff Stein.
I'm Michael Isikoff.
And I'm Karen Greenberg.
See you next time.
For more original reporting and insights like this, subscribe to spytalk.co on Substack and follow us on Twitter at talk_spy. If you enjoyed our podcast, subscribe and leave a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
MSW Media.
History is messy. It's weird, wild, and anything but boring. Rainy Day Rabbit Holes is a history podcast about unhinged stories that make you stop and ask, wait, is this real life?
From crazy disasters and tasty scandals to enlightening and surprising heartwarming tales, we explore the moments where people behave badly and sometimes beautifully.
We've got naughty politicians, cultural chaos, and a deep love for the Pacific Northwest, including Bigfoot.
It's thoughtful, irreverent, occasionally serious, and always entertaining.
Let's fall down the rabbit hole.
MSW Media.